From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina continues to serve as an example for state-level tax reformers across the country. You'll hear why from the head of the group, Americans for Tax Reform. Some state lawmakers are pushing for the official end of the controversial MAP Act. It violated private property rights, and state courts have ruled in favor of Forsyth County property owners who challenged the MAP Act. Lawmakers are also considering a new financial literacy requirement for the state's public schools. You'll learn why the measure is attracting bipartisan support. And you'll learn why solar energy could be forcing Duke Energy customers to pay more than $1 billion in higher bills over the next 10 to 15 years. If it makes you mad, be prepared to blame state government. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us now. She has the Carolina Journal headline.
For the second year, the North Carolina Association of Educators, the NCAE, is planning a rally and protest at the General Assembly that has already resulted in multiple school district cancellations of the school day. Organizers are calling for more pay, as well as the expansion of Medicaid in North Carolina, and several other things as well. But our next guest says that union activists are actually drowning out serious concerns of dedicated teachers, parents, and kids. Terry Stoops is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Who are these activists? Give us a sense of who populates the NCAE, and do they have allied groups with them?
Yeah, this is a group of activist teachers that are mainly centered around the North Carolina Association of Educators, which is the state affiliate to the National Education Association, the largest teacher union here in the United States. And these are a small group of teachers, mainly from urban counties and suburban counties, that believe that North Carolina teachers need to be unionized, essentially. And so this is a step toward trying to unionize the teacher workforce. They are trying to use social media to get as many protesters here on the May 1st event in North Carolina, with the ultimate goal of convincing legislators sometime in the future to allow them to have collective bargaining rights and other things that traditional unions have.
We had a similar episode last year, that a protest, a rally, we had school days shut down across the state. You had a massive gathering in Raleigh, and it ended up in a teacher pay raise. So from the perspective of those activists, that was pretty successful. Are they trying to build on that?
Well, they are trying to build off of last year's May 16th event. They changed a few things up this year. Number one, they decided to have a different agenda. Going in, they were rather disorganized when they were asked what they wanted, because they wanted higher teacher pay and they were going to get higher teacher pay. The Republicans had already announced before the event that they were going to get higher pay. But there was also some rhetoric by Mark Jewell, the head of the NCAE, ahead of that May 16th event last year, where he was talking about getting rid of the Republicans in the General Assembly, having new people get in charge. We're not hearing that same kind of rhetoric here in the May 1st event that is coming up. They are a little more focused on their five policy priorities, rather than talking about the political goals that they most certainly have behind the scenes, but are less explicit about in public.
Teacher pay seems to be number one on the list. Now, we know that you mentioned that last time around, last year, the Republicans who had the majority in the legislature had already determined and built in a teacher pay raise into the budget. That, I believe, was the fifth pay raise in a row for teachers. Mm-hmm. So now the activists are saying that they want a sixth?
That's right, and they're going to get it. I mean, there is going to be a teacher pay raise. The Republicans have already made that promise. We just don't know what kind of pay raise it's going to be. We don't know how much money is going to be set aside or what percentage that pay increase is going to be or how it's going to be distributed. But Republicans have already made clear that they are going to raise teacher pay. This will be the sixth consecutive teacher pay raise. That doesn't include the increases in total compensation, the health care costs that have been going up that Republicans have paid for, and the increase in the pension contributions that Republicans have always been very faithful about providing.
Terry, you mentioned that there is a list, essentially five key planks that the activists and the folks who are going to be marching and protesting have said are their core requirements, so to speak. And there are several of them that are kind of head scratchers to me because they don't really relate to education, one of them being Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, their reasoning here with their demand that the General Assembly increase Medicaid is that it will provide healthier adults, which will then provide the means for children to be in healthier homes and therefore increase student achievement. It's a roundabout sort of reasoning here that is, you know, something that probably doesn't belong on their list of five demands, but is consistent with some of the Democratic Party platform in which they're getting some of their policy ideas from. So I see this less as an education policy, as a nod to the Democratic wing, the Democratic inspiration for their policy ideas and for their policy prescriptions.
Terry, this is probably going to be a very large gathering. Interesting that at least as of the time that you and I are talking about this, it is scheduled for May 1st. We've seen the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Mark Johnson, try to urge the activists to not do this on a school day. He's asking them to do it on a day when they would normally be off because we already have seen announcements from multiple public school districts in the state. They're going to have to shut down school because there won't be enough teachers.
That's right. And I give Mark Johnson all the credit in the world for standing against some of these radical teachers and talking about the fact that this needs to happen on a non-instructional day. One thing to remember is that we had schools because of Hurricane Florence that were out for weeks. They didn't have class for weeks, and they're still catching up in anticipation of state testing that happens in May and June. If these kids lose a day, just weeks before they encounter state testing, that's going to be significant. And even more significant for the low-income kids in these Hurricane Florence-affected counties. So this is a serious matter. It's an academic matter. And frankly, the fact that they're willing to have this in the middle of an instructional week suggests that they don't really have the children's best interests at heart. They're not really thinking about the fact that it is significant to lose an instructional day. Instead, they believe that they can bolt from their jobs on a Wednesday and have school canceled so that they can come to Raleigh to wear red and to flash signs in front of legislators, hoping that that they will adopt a list of policy prescriptions that they have advanced in their social media campaigns.
Terry, what you've described and as we've discussed the planks that the organizers of the protest have put out, it sounds more like a worker rights movement, a worker rights action versus talking about student achievement. How can we work together to try to help North Carolina's kids? I know that you've been putting together a more student-focused agenda because you and others are concerned that the activists are going to drown out some real issues that we could be working together on.
That's exactly right. Student achievement should be the primary concern. We have relatively low percentages of students that are proficient, especially our students of color that are proficient in reading and math. These should be the focus. If anything, we should have a list of agenda items that are focused on raising student achievement. That should be our sole focus. And instead, if you look at the list of demands for this May 1st march, you don't see students appearing much. You have to stretch to find a way that student performance increased if the General Assembly would adopt any of the five planks for their demands. And that should be really be what we need to think about when we talk about what teachers need to be doing. They need to be in class, focused on student achievement. They shouldn't be trying to cancel class so that they can come to Raleigh for a walkout.
We will have you back to assess how this goes. Again, at this point, we do believe it's going to take place on May 1st. So we'll have you back to talk about what occurs. Dr. Terry Stoops is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has attracted national attention for its tax reforms since 2013. Does this state remain a role model for tax reformers across the country? Are other states following our lead or setting even better examples? Joining us now to help address those questions is Grover Norquist. He's president of the group Americans for Tax Reform. Welcome back to the program.
Absolutely. Good to be with you. Look, a lot of people talk about Texas, no income tax, Florida, no income tax, Nevada, no income tax, Tennessee, no income tax. And that's important. But what the other states really need is the model of how to get there. It doesn't do you any good to tell you somebody else is at the mountaintop if you're at the bottom. And what North Carolina has done has been a model for other states. As I travel around the country, people say, I want to be Texas. I want to be Florida. But I want to do it like North Carolina. And they see the model of bringing individual and the corporate income tax down with repeated reductions, tying it to revenue growth. As revenue hits this number, then we'll bring the corporate rate down and the individual rate down. That way you never get ahead of your ski tips. The counter example was Kansas, which had some dramatic reductions on spending, and they had a very good forward-looking as revenue goes up. We bring down the rates. They had a problem with the Supreme Court, which mandated hundreds of millions of dollars of spending, so they couldn't match that. And they weren't focused on reining in spending at the same time that they were quite understandably correctly focused on bringing down taxes. So North Carolina has done it steady as she goes, two steps forward, three steps forward, no steps back, but not throwing a Hail Mary pass. 3 yards and a cloud of dust. And every single step has been reasonable, understandable, and only the thoroughly dishonest left argues, the world's going to go to Hades. No, it's a very modest shift down, down, lower, lower on corporate and individual rates. North Carolina used to be the high tax state in the region in income taxes. Now it's a lower tax state and clearly en route to zero. Clearly en route to zero. I was in Arizona and people were saying, we want to do what North Carolina did. I've been in Oklahoma and people say, we want to be like North Carolina. So it is helping North Carolina citizens with its approach, step-by-step approach to get to zero personal income tax, zero corporate income tax. They're certainly reaping the benefits of investment and migration from other states, from high-tax states into North Carolina. But you're also benefiting the rest of the country.
You mentioned that you talked to people in other states who would like to get to the zero point and use North Carolina's path to get there. Are there any other states that you're seeing now that you say, okay, North Carolina, you started this ball, but now you ought to be watching what this state's doing and follow their lead?
Well, a number of states have gotten rid of their franchise taxes, which is a particularly destructive tax. 17 states still have it, but even many of those are looking to phase it out. Mississippi is, I think, 4 years into a 10-year phase out of their franchise tax. So saying we're going to get – let's say we can't, quote, unquote, afford to get rid of it in 1 year. Okay. Stretch it out. How many years do you think you can take a bite of the apple each year? But make it a clear path to zero, not we'll cut it a little bit, we'll cut it a little bit. People looking to move into North Carolina, as many do, or expand here, which is probably more frequent, are looking at the franchise tax and going, you know, on the other border, we don't have the franchise tax. But if they know that North Carolina decided it's going, that's a big incentive to invest in job creation in North Carolina.
We are chatting with Grover Norquist. He is president of the group Americans for Tax Reform. I want to loop back to something you mentioned earlier, and that is that while tax rates have gone down, a big drop at first and then incrementally since then, the North Carolina government has also focused on keeping a lid on spending increases mm-hmm. in the budget. How important is that?
It's very important to keep spending down and to trend it down, to constantly check, because government spending creeps up if you don't do anything. It's like middle-aged people gain weight if they don't do something. You have to actively decide you're not going to gain weight. Governments, everybody in the government thinks that if they had more money, they could do X, Y, or Z, and they all fight for it. They all quite recognize that it's a waste of money to spend it someplace else, but they don't have the same self-knowledge in their own department. So having an ethos that you weigh yourself every morning, keep checking how much is the government spending, and what are they promising for the future? Governments tend to grow by saying, well, we don't want to raise spending now, so tell you what, we'll raise your pension. So 30 years from now, when I'm dead, the mayor will have to go raise taxes to pay for the city pensions. So watching for promises of spending in the future is every bit as important, maybe more important, than focusing on let's not raise spending right now.
As we talk to some of the lawmakers who've been involved in this process and have been involved in cutting the rates, occasionally you'll hear someone who says, you know, we've cut the rates and our revenues have gone up, so we really don't need to worry that much about the spending side. Why are they thinking in the wrong way if that's the way they're thinking?
Well, a couple of things happened. That's what happened to Connecticut and Kansas. When Obama said we're going to raise capital gains taxes in January, a lot of people sold stock. And in the last quarter of, I believe it was 2011, Connecticut got $400 million more than they'd expected. And they go, we're rich. We have this permanent $400 million a quarter new spending coming in. They'd missed. It was all driven by a one-time change. And Kansas, they got about $80 billion. And they said, oh, well, our supply-side tax cuts, which did create growth and jobs, is really on steroids and much faster than we expected. And then they decided to go increase spending based on the higher projections, which then got you the backlash from the establishment press and from Democrats and from weak-willed Republicans who said, oh, no, now we have to get rid of not the overspending, but the tax cut. They undid their tax cut by overestimating and increasing spending. I think you're much better off reacting very slowly to sudden increases in income. And when you see them lasting, that's the time to start, and again, bring the taxes down a little more.
Following up on that, for North Carolina, obviously, we're interested in keeping the tax rates as low as possible and seeing government have the money it needs to run. From the national perspective, how important is it to you that North Carolina continue on this path and not become another Kansas?
It's extremely important because states that crash and burn often come to Washington and want to loot the rest of the country. And solid, pro-growth, stable, functioning states are the bulwark against bailing out California when it goes bankrupt. Who is going to say no when Illinois goes, we need money or we're bankrupt? The answer is go bankrupt, like General Motors should have. And it's very important that some states get it right because you need good examples. You need good examples. You know, throughout history, people look at heroes as good examples in their own personal life. But how do you live your life? How do you run your state? You got to look around at the other 49 states and say, Let's be like North Carolina. Let's be like Arizona. Let's be like Texas. Let's not be like Illinois. And the more good examples they are, the more credible they are. Over time, some states perform better than others because they have lower taxes, less regulation.
As North Carolina continues along its path, we know one person who's going to be watching very closely is Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. After more than 30 years, North Carolina's controversial MAP Act might be on its way out. Republican State Representative Deborah Conrad explains.
It was enacted in 1987. It authorized the North Carolina Department of Transportation to file maps, and that froze people's property. And in my county, for example, Forsyth County, it's been over 20 years. That they had to endure the negative impact of the MAP Act. Probably the most known court case on this was Kirby versus North Carolina Department of Transportation. And the courts found that the MAP Act restrictions with regard to property in the corridor, and this was in Forsyth County for our Beltway project, that it did amount to a taking, and that the property owners were due just compensation. That was not the opinion of the Department of Transportation. Since then, we have pretty much had a moratorium on the MAP Act, but now we are finally going to put the nails in the coffin and repeal it, which I think will is a good day for property rights. Most other states build roads without this type of process. We have a new strategic transportation plan in place, and we will forge ahead with that. the vast majority of people are not going to buy a house in the path of a corridor. You also really couldn't expand and improve your house, because the whole point is the DOT wants to pay as little as possible for these properties, so they certainly don't want you to improve the property, say if you needed to add an extra bedroom. They were also buying and renting some of these properties and undercutting the rental market. So it definitely, on many different fronts, the MAP Act had a negative impact on the real estate market.
Representative Dana Bumgardner responded to Conrad's bill to end the MAP Act.
What this bill is really about is keeping DOT from tying up property for 30 years and not compensating people for it. That's really what this is about, which is what they've been doing.
That's it in a nutshell, and it impacted a lot of farmers as well. They might need to build a new grain silo or something, and they were prohibited for doing that. So it impacted a lot of people's lives in a negative way.
Representative John Torbett tallied the MAP Act's costs.
One might ask, what's that going to cost the taxpayer of the state? Right now, they're estimating they're one-third of the way through with litigation, and the sum they have paid out to date is around $230 million. So one can safely do the math to know somewhere over $600 million will be the cost to complete the purchasing of the right-of-ways involved in the current litigation. So as we look at funding and we take two steps forward, this is going to be a step sideways.
You've been listening to Debate About Repealing North Carolina's Controversial MAP Act. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some state lawmakers want to ensure that students learn something in high school about finances. They're pursuing a bill called the Economics and Financial Literacy Act. Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest is offering vocal support for the idea.
This is bipartisan legislation. There is nothing about this legislation that I think anybody's going to stand against in any way. In fact, I think the vast majority of North Carolinians would probably already believe that we're teaching economics and financial literacy in our schools right now. We would just assume that that is the case, but it's not the case. And hence we have, $22 trillion of debt in this nation. We have $100 trillion worth of unfunded liabilities in our country right now. We have student debt becoming the largest form of debt in America, even beyond mortgage debt. And that's kind of incomprehensible in this day and age. $38,000 per student in America today for student loan debt. We have to start to deal with these things in the classroom. We need to deal with them long before college, in fact. And that's really what this legislation is about. It's about making it a requirement for every high school student to pass this economic/financial literacy requirement course. We're not really adding anything extra onto the teacher's plate here. We're going to reorganize some things so that they can make room for it in the classroom. But if we really want to continue to talk about the ills of the things going on in our country related to financial literacy, 40% of Americans today cannot even afford a $400 bill. If they have an unexpected $400 bill or invoice that comes due, they're going to have to borrow money, have to put it on credit, or they're going to have to sell something. Half of Americans right now have more credit debt than they do savings.
Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest offers more sobering statistics about Americans' finances.
The average North Carolina household is indebted, on average, $8,683 on credit debt. So 21% of Americans have nothing, zero, saved up for retirement. Only 15% of Americans are now on track to have 1 year of retirement savings in the bank. Only 15% of Americans. And so knowing these facts and knowing these figures obviously tells us that we have some work to do. There's always more work to do in education, but I'm a firm believer in the basics, that we need to get the basics right, that we need to teach our high school students the basics of life, what they're getting ready to get into as they exit high school and go to work in a job or go off to college. And financial literacy is purely just the basics.
Forrest sees benefits that extend beyond the students.
And not only does this benefit the students, I think this is going to benefit the teachers and the principals as well. In fact, we've already heard from the folks that train, that do the financial literacy and economics training, that teachers come out of the training saying, how come I have never learned this? This is good for me, and it's good for my family. Why have I never learned these things?
Republican State Senator Jerry Tillman of Randolph County is a main sponsor of the Economics and Financial Literacy Act.
We've got kids that are graduating from high school that don't know how to balance a checkbook. They don't know how to handle credit. They don't know how to handle a credit card. They don't know how to handle money. They don't know how banks work. They don't know how money works. They don't know how interest works. They don't know anything about mortgage payments. But with a very few short years, and some of them are already into this, where you're a homeowner, you are a spouse, you soon will be having children if you don't already. There's a lot of things, just basic stuff, that these kids need to know. So many kids go out into this world without a clue about how to handle money, how banks work, how the world of money works. It's something that's basic, and yet they don't know. I've got three kids that are grown now. All of them had to learn these things while trying to do those things, okay? Learning by experience, you can get burned.
Tillman explains the details of the Economics and Financial Literacy Act.
It's the first time in our history that high school students must take and pass an economic and personal finance course prior to graduating. Take and pass. It will be a graduation requirement, one of the 20 or 21 now that will be required. It will be a standalone course and not wedged into a civic class or into another type class. It will be a standalone course, standing on its own merits.
The idea already has some bipartisan support. Democratic State Senator Jay Chaudhary of Wake County is a primary sponsor.
This bill makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense because by requiring the State Board of Education and Department of Public Instruction to create a standalone economic and personal finance course, we will make sure that our students receive the financial literacy and instruction that they need and deserve. We can do this without creating any additional requirements for teachers in restructuring the current social studies curriculum. Let me say, as the former general counsel at the North Carolina Department of State Treasurer, I can tell you that it's critical we provide retirement security to all of our citizens, but here's the reality. In our country, we have almost a quarter of our families that have no money in their retirement accounts, and if you look at the median family holdings today, they only have $5,000 in their savings. And we cannot meet our retirement security unless we educate and empower our young people about the importance of money, and this bill does exactly that. If you think about high school students and how they earn and spend money, this bill makes a lot of sense. It will teach them about how to select a credit card. It will teach them about credit scores, and it will teach them about planning and paying for college, including understanding what a monthly debt payment might mean after graduation. And I believe that this curriculum, combined with a high school student's real-life financial experience, will create a series of teachable moments. Through this bill, a high school student will retain and remember, I believe, that these important financial lessons. The statistics show us that such a financial literacy courses are needed. According to one study, only 24% of millennials demonstrate basic financial literacy. Nearly half don't believe that they can come up with $2,000 if an unexpected need arose within the next 12 months, and more than half of them carried a credit card balance in the last year. This bill also recognizes that a school needs a good partner to carry out a comprehensive financial literacy program. And again, I commend Senator Tillman and Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest for finding a great partner in the North Carolina Council of Economic Education, an organization that I've known since my time serving at the Department of State Treasurer. The money dedicated to this money will help train teachers who have the knowledge and confidence to educate a whole new generation of financially savvy students. Let me say from a personal perspective, I wish that I had a course like this when I attended high school back in Fayetteville.
Senator Jay Chaudhary says he might have made some different financial decisions if he had the class proposed in the Economics and Financial Literacy Act.
To quote Dave Ramsey, we buy things we don't need with money we don't have to impress people we don't like. And while our spending never reflected Dave Ramsey's statement, we made some personal financial changes, changes that I wish I had learned back in high school. I'm going to end by quoting Marty Stewart, who has a song called Too Much Month at the End of the Money. I paid the bank note, the car note, and yes, I paid the phone bill too. And then I turned around and I found that the house note's due. Well, I'd love to take you out like I said I would, honey, but there's too much month at the end of the month.
That's Democratic State Senator Jay Chaudhary, one of the bipartisan sponsors of a measure to increase financial literacy among North Carolina's high school students. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Roughly $1.25 billion, that is how much Duke Energy customers will be overpaying for electricity over the next 10 to 15 years. Our next guest writes that we can thank North Carolina law, along with Governor Roy Cooper, for the higher bills that are coming with these long-term solar energy contracts the Duke has been forced to accept. Don Vandervaart is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. During the McCrory years, he was the secretary of the Department of Environmental Quality. You were also the state's energy policy advisor. So, in other words, you know your stuff. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks.
Don, first of all, why is solar booming in North Carolina?
That's a great question. It is also slightly complicated, but the short answer is it is booming in North Carolina because of government subsidies, both state and federal. And North Carolina had more subsidies and more interpretations of federal law that were amenable to solar than any other state.
I come from Arizona, so one would think, well, gee, the desert, maybe Arizona, maybe Texas, maybe California would be leading the country in solar power and solar plants, but North Carolina is right up there.
Arizona actually has a better, what we call, solar resource. In other words, the sun shines there more often. And so that your question makes sense. North Carolina, due to North Carolina law that was passed in 2007 or 8, decided that they were going to have the taxpayer subsidize much of the growth. They did that, because they didn't want all of these costs to rest with the ratepayer. You would have seen dramatic increases in our rates had not some $2 billion worth of this investment come from the taxpayer instead. So the taxpayers are on the hook for about $2 billion or more. But there were other interpretations that the state has made, specifically of federal law, that are also very, very attractive to solar plants, so much so that North Carolina now is the number one state in this federally qualified definition of solar. And solar plants. And what that means is that our utilities have to buy the power that comes from them, and they have to be put in these long-term contracts that are very profitable.
So what you're saying, it sounds like to me, is that the solar industry is not growing just naturally based on market dynamics here in North Carolina. It's essentially propped up by subsidies and laws that make it very favorable
to operate. Insofar as state and federal mandates not being natural, you're correct. If they were gone, you would see them stop. You would see the expansion stop or slow down dramatically. And of course, that's the topic of an email that we know was sent by the head of one of the largest solar companies here in North Carolina to Governor Cooper himself, appealing to the governor to try to force Duke into going back and taking an outdated interpretation of this federal law.
Here's what's fascinating. First of all, I would encourage folks to read your piece published at CarolinaJournal.com. The headline, "Thanks to Solar Power Deals, Your Electric Bill is Higher." One of the things you write, Don, is that if people want to somehow say, oh, that darn power company, my bill is too high, actually Duke had been sounding the alarm about a couple of things, and one of them was the higher bills.
For 2 years prior to this year, Duke had been recognizing that these old contracts that they had signed and that were going to be in place for 15 years were very disadvantageous to the ratepayer. And what they were trying to do was get the Utilities Commission to change the interpretation of this federal law. And ultimately, it's our state legislature that stepped in and made that action. And that became House Bill 589. And I won't go into all those things, but there were because of the changed interpretation of this federal law, the estimates were that customers were going to save $850 million going forward under this new interpretation.
So are you telling me that the electric bill that Duke customers are getting in the mail and will continue to receive going forward actually could be lower than what they're going to receive?
In fact, right now, Duke was saying, right now we're already overpaying some $1 billion, and they wanted that to stop. Because of HB 589, you're exactly right. You were going to see a drop in your bills going forward. Unfortunately, that didn't happen.
Now, the folks at Duke also had been trying to get folks to pay attention to them because they were a little bit concerned about what's termed the stability of the electric grid and how that relates to renewables and solar power in particular. What's the concern there?
Well, it's pretty intuitive to understand that when the sun shines, these solar plants pump out the electricity and the rest of the generating system has to drop back. When it's cloudy or when the sun doesn't shine for whatever reason, it reverses. And in fact, during the day, that goes on quite a bit.
Kind of a seesaw effect.
It's very hard on the other combustion turbines, but it's also very hard on the grid itself because, as you can imagine, those need to be balanced for us to have a constant supply. So what Duke had said was, look, it was fine when we first started this. We had some play in the system, and we could absorb these new intermittent generator plants. But we're at the end of that, and so going forward, if we add more, you're going to risk an unstable grid, or we're going to have to spend a whole lot of money to accommodate these increased growth in solar. So they brought that up as well. Going forward, I think we're still I think some of their concerns are going to be realized.
You mentioned that the General Assembly at one point had gotten involved and was taking steps to sort of rein in some of these long-term expensive solar contracts. But then Governor Roy Cooper got involved in this. Help us understand what role he played.
So the bill got passed, and they had these consumer protections built in, namely that going forward, these rates were going to be competitively determined, and there wouldn't be as many of them signed. That wasn't going to be beneficial, particularly to the solar industry, and they appealed to Governor Cooper. apparently, according to the reports from a news agency at WBTV, Roy Cooper, Governor Cooper, then withheld or used as leverage a permit Duke needed for another project for the pipeline to force Duke into signing a settlement that essentially undid those protections that the legislature put in HB 589.
Wouldn't an action like that generate a whole lot of questions by all sorts of people involved in this?
Obviously, it's pretty complicated. I'm having trouble explaining it now.
You're doing a good job.
And so there is a lot of misinformation out there. Some people think that the little rider that's on your power bill is the only amount that we pay for solar. That's not true. That's only for one facet of the of one of the laws. The overwhelming majority of the additional costs are buried in your rate, and that's unfortunate.
Now, there is a legislative action. There's an investigation going on of several different things, including these questions?
Exactly. And so if it turns out that the reporter from WBTV was correct, that there really was extortion, if you will, being applied to Duke, then that's very serious indeed. And the legislature has taken the historic step of actually hiring investigators. If it turns out that that Duke had to sign under duress, I think that settlement ought to be nullified.
Don Vandervaart is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. Don, thank you.
Thank you.
Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.